There's an awful lot that can be said about pagan literature. This is huge, a huge, huge subject that people give their whole life to. Actually, I think I could say that about any one of these different presentations. But let's take 35 minutes and we'll talk about these. What's the big picture that I want you to know? I want you to understand that, for example, we have documents from Egypt and Mesopotamia that talk about man's origins. Would that be surprising? The Memphite theology of Egypt is an Egyptian view of creation. Page 188 will give you a little bit of an overview of these things. Wouldn't you expect that? Wouldn't you expect that ancient peoples would have some kind of explanation to how the world came to be? I mean, people do today. Every man and woman, child, wonders about these things. Enuma Elish, then, would be a Mesopotamian version of creation, as is the Atrahasis epic that moves on into this flood and talks about a worldwide flood. Does that sound a little familiar? Gilgamesh epic focuses specifically on the flood. And we find parallels between the Old Testament and these ancient records. Is that surprising?
It is. It's in Hinduism also.
Why is that surprising?
But this, they say that they observe the turtle, there was a flood, and they put into the turtle and saved.
Is this Hindu?
Hinduism.
Don't the Hindus believe that the whole world
was created by one called Mahabharata?
Was is
through the water.
And most belief systems believe that the world came through water, through some kind of watery chaos. You know, that really makes sense to me. And it, when I first heard these things, it made me wonder, whoa, is the Bible actually copying these things? For example, take a look at the Atrahasis epic. It's traced to 1650 BC. Now, Moses lived around 1500 BC. So this record of creation and the flood is actually preceding Moses by 1,500 years. It's a record of why the creation came about. Just quoting from Atrahasis epic itself, it says, quote, "Let the birth goddess create offspring and let man bear the toil of the gods." Get it? The gods were lazy. The upper gods, the higher gods, created the lower gods to do the work, but they didn't want to do the work. So we better have someone else who does the work. So let's create people. That's why you were created. You were wondering why you were created, right? You're created to be a slave of the gods, from a Mesopotamian perspective. Don't you feel better about yourself now? Because you know, from a biblical perspective, God didn't make you to be a slave. God made you to be a ruler with him, to rule over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and all the land animals. Do you see the high place that the scripture places on you and me in comparison to these pagan records? It says, The goal is to create humanity that he may bear the yoke. Let Nintu mix clay, that God and man may be thoroughly mixed in the clay, and let there be a spirit from the God's flesh. So man was made from clay. Man was made from dirt. Now, do you find that surprising?
One side is surprised.
One side surprised? What side is surprised?
Because they also knows about the creation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a.
So would you be surprised that they would know something about creation from a pagan standpoint?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a true story. That's what we came through also, other people
yeah.
also knows about this.
I really need to diagram this, but the way I would diagram it is you have the actual true story that Noah and his sons spread and taught people, right? So there's a true story of creation and the flood. Then it gets corrupted by all these various peoples, and various parts of the true story find repetition, but then other things get changed as well. Especially with these various cultures trying to highlight the importance of the god of their city or their country. They want to exalt that god, so they portray that god is the one who's really the creator god, the one worthy of worship. And then later on, we end up seeing Moses getting divine revelation on how the creation truly happened to restore the actual creation story. That's what I think happened. I think you also have to address the fact that, well, people know that our bodies end up back in dirt. We know that we actually came from dirt, because if you take your spirit out of your body and you take all the water out of your body, guess what? We're all basically dust. We're all basically dirt. I don't want you to feel bad about yourself, but if you want a biblical definition of you, it is you, your spirit, plus water, plus dirt, equals you. That's who you are. But you're far better than that, because God says that you, plus water, plus dirt, is made in His image. So He took the very simple thing like clay or dirt and fashioned it into one actually made into His image. So an amazing thing to think about. And I have not even begun to explore all the wonderful things of what it means to be made in the image of God. But I know that one of the things that it clearly says in Genesis 1:26 is that we are made to rule. If it says three times that we are to subdue, and that we are to rule over the birds of the air, the sea creatures, and the land animals. So it's a very high purpose for which God took very simple things like dirt. It's kind of amazing to think about. And so, yes, we do have similarities. The Atrahasis epic has Anu instead of Yahweh as the creator. But when it moves on into the flood, it says the reason why Anu sent the flood was because man was too noisy. And the gods got really upset at people. You guys are so noisy down there. I'm going to send a flood and kill you all. So Atrahasis builds a boat. You see, that's how he actually escaped the flood. Same way as Noah. Pitch was used. Animals were caught. In their case, they rained only 7 days rather than 40 days. But the gods end up regretting sending the flood at the end. Whereas God, I don't know if you could say God himself in Genesis 9 regrets sending the flood, but he does say, I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to send a worldwide flood again. So maybe you could say, well, there is a sense of sadness there that God himself had in showing this. But you can see how the true story would actually be changing along the way. Okay, any of your thoughts on this? I just wonder if this is kind of new thoughts for you, or I had to process this a little bit when I found out about it, especially when I found out that some of these stories were actually written before Moses.
Yeah.
That was a struggle for me.
Moses was the one who wrote the Genesis and everything. He's the one who's title. So before the story is passed on, like, you know, verbally they spoke about this flood and everything. So every culture knew about this.
Yeah, there definitely was a verbal, an oral tradition of the flood.
So and creation. Wrote with the inspiration of God, the spirit of God, and what happened, and he wrote what God wanted to tell.
Yes.
The side of God. The others, you know, they knew what happened. So they have different context of.
Yeah, Moses. Well, there has to be divine inspiration here as well. Because, you know, I mean, who was a witness to creation? Let me ask this. Was Adam witness to creation? Even Adam and Eve were not witnesses. Adam wasn't there the first 6 days until he was created at the end of the sixth day. And even when Eve was created, Adam was sleeping. It's hard to be a witness when you're sleeping, right? If you're sleeping through something and then you're called in as a witness to court, in court, hopefully you'll be honest enough to say, well, sorry, I was asleep during that whole thing. I had no idea.
Adam had questions, no? So Adam must have spoke about God and asked, how did I come about? And, you know, so God must have told Adam.
Exactly. I don't think Adam was any different than anyone else. He would have questioned God like any of your children have asked, well, where did I come from? You know, is there... In fact, these are the key questions of life. Origin, where did I come from? Secondly is, what went wrong? You know? Why is the world in such a mess it is in? That's the idea. And then, and is there any meaning in life? Even if the world was created in a wonderful way and things went wrong, well, where's their meaning? Where's their purpose? And then lastly, is there any hope? Where's it all going? What's the destiny? So those questions of the way I sought to say it in my Genesis teaching is actually based on those four questions of.
So now, this kind of like other creation stories, because they had a oral. Spoken or something, they put it in the writing. So because only God knows the true story, how it's happened and everything. So that's what we call Moses to write it down, to put it in the right way.
Yeah, I think because the reason Moses wrote it down is because we all have a basic need to know the story. Let me see if I can say it this way from my other class. I'll just add this slide to it. I hadn't really thought about it till now, but these questions, where did we come from, is also an I question. Adam himself could have asked this question of origin. Where did I come from? So God himself had to reveal that to him. Purpose, why am I here? Have you heard people ask you that question? I hope you have. I hope you've asked it yourself. Why am I here? When people ask me, I don't really know why I'm here, I say, just turn to Genesis 1:26. It'll tell you why you're here. You have been made to rule creation. God gave you this position as this responsibility, as a co-regent. A co-king or queen with him. Everybody has to answer the origin question. Everybody has to answer the purpose question. Is there meaning? Everybody has to answer the morality question. Why is there evil in the world? And everybody has to answer the destiny question. Where am I going? Is there any hope? So I would encourage you to think of these four questions, OPMD, origin, purpose, morality, and destiny. Now, various religions come to different understandings of these. For example, most of you are ministering in a Buddhist context. Where did we come from? From a Buddhist perspective?
They say that some combination of this thing, they are part.
Yeah, it's basically evolution. It's basically non-directed, unformed. Why am I here? How would a Buddhist answer that question? Is there meaning in life? How does reincarnation answer the question, why I'm here, and is there any meaning? So this is helpful for us to think in terms of these questions. These are good questions to ask to people that will help express our own worldview and their own worldview. And you can dialogue with these sort of things. I talk with with people about these sort of things myself, like morality. Why is homosexual marriage right now, but it wasn't right 20 years ago? Why? Why did it all of a sudden become right? And why is there evil in the world? Would be the more fundamental question. Why is morality changing? Or is it actually changing? And destiny, where am I going? Is there any hope in my future? These are very, very important questions. And we're having an abbreviated session here, but it's pretty clear that Genesis is saying that God was going to destroy everything because of their sin, and Noah found favor with the Lord. It says in Genesis 6, God saw how corrupt the world had become, and God said, I am going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence. So we see God choosing Noah, and Noah by faith building this large boat, Hebrews 11 says. We see these silly little pictures of bathtub arks. I don't think so. I think the ark was an amazing, ingenious construction of Noah and his sons, and certainly would have taken them a long time to do that, to put in even flower beds and be growing things inside the ark and be able to figure all these things. If you look at the biblical measurements for the ark based on an 18-inch hand and arm cubit, you actually end up seeing that the ark was at 300 cubits long, longer than a football field, with three decks, and able to sustain waves of up to 200 feet high. It's a pretty incredible thing to realize that this boat was really seaworthy. On the Gilgamesh epic, it's actually a square boat. It's not very seaworthy. It would have been easily tipped over. But you find all this detail about the flood chronology that brings us all into understanding what God was actually doing there. There's actually, some of it talked about Gordon Wenham in his book on Genesis 1 to 15. Talks about a chiasm that focuses on God remembering Noah. You guys study chiasms where you have literary arrangement with an element at the beginning, 7 days of waiting, and then 7 days of waiting at the end that are parallel. 7 days of waiting for the flood, 7 days of waiting, chapter 8. What that does is it puts the focus of the whole narrative on God remembering Noah. And here's the point. God had to destroy the whole world, but God still remembered Noah. And he does the same today in the midst of his judgment. We see that the ages of people changed significantly after the flood, where they're living 900 plus years prior to that time, but then after the flood it goes down very sharply. Noah was already 600 years, but he lived some 350 years after the flood. And Shem, by the time you get down to Abraham and Moses and David, about 100 years is considered quite old, as even as it is today. And the flood explains why lifespans did shorten, because we've got the flood so changing the dynamic in the world that the world today is not able to sustain these long life spans that it was back then. You even see some indication of people believing in long lives, at least of kings, in the Sumerian culture. The Sumerian king list, ascribed about 1800 BC, this would be 300 years after Moses, it shows the reign of these various kings. When kingship came down from heaven, the Sumerian king list says, Alulim became king and he reigned 28,800 years. In fact, there were eight kings that reigned a total of 241,000 years. And then the flood water streamed over the earth. There's obviously problems here. There's three of these eight kings that had exactly 28,800 years, which makes it, to me, a little bit suspect. But what it does show is that there are other beliefs there from others besides just the Hebrews in this longevity of life. In other words, this is not significantly different. Yes, there's a difference between living 28,000 and 900 years. You know, that's huge. But which reminds me of Methuselah, who says, I just turned 969 years old and people keep telling me how old I am. I tell them, I'm not old. The earth is old. It's almost 700 years older than I am. So says Methuselah, because he believed in an old earth, much older than him, you know.
So, is flatness changed the body condition or the earth condition? Why is this?
I don't know if the flood changed our bodily condition as much as it changed the earth. Because I think our bodies, there was no real change in Noah and his sons in terms of their bodies. But that said, the kind of genetic problems with our bodies, generation after generation after generation, has accumulated over the centuries. So in that sense, our bodies now are not nearly as amazing as they were back then. In fact, I believe people were much, much taller back then. Much taller than we are now. I think they were healthier. They didn't have all the problems that we have, all the diseases we have.
Skeleton, they have found the big skeleton. Is it true?
I've seen some of these pictures of huge human skeletons next to people. Honestly, I don't know whether those are photoshopped or not. Unless it's verified by someone who's quite reliable, I wouldn't believe it. But that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. We have to decide where we're going to place our faith, because everybody has faith. The atheist scientist has faith also. He just will not acknowledge that he has faith. Faith means you believe something and then you're waiting for the evidence for it, in many cases. I don't think that's the greatest definition of our faith. We place our faith in, we have a reasonable faith that there's a God who created an ordered world, is what we see. We have a faith that animals reproduce after their own kind. Isn't that a reasonable faith? That is what we see today. So I would call my faith a reasonable faith, whereas The faith that one species turns into another species, I would call that an unreasonable faith, because there's no evidence for it. There's evidence in the fossil record for different species, but there's no evidence that one species turned into another species. There's evidence for extinct animals, yes, but there's no evidence that those came from other extinct animals. There's no evidence that reptiles evolved into birds, etc. We could get into all this. In fact, I would love to teach a whole course on this. If you go to the creation link of my website, you'll find about 3,000 slides related to the whole issue of creation and all different aspects of creation. But sad to say, we have to just keep going, you know. And so I'm going to...
Sir.
Yes.
Natural faith, what you say is, the natural God created naturally certain things to operate on this earth.
I would say that God works supernaturally,
yeah.
Not naturally, but yeah.
God can do some supernatural,
yeah.
But in the creation story and all, we can see natural way production.
Yeah.
Everything's,
yeah.
Natural. It's,
yes.
God intended that became a natural for us. So, in that case, the New Testament, when we come for a supernatural things, how much we have to take these natural things to our lives? How much we have to concern?
Okay, that's a great question. If we're saying that God does things in a natural way, God has created these natural laws, then we're giving a reasonable explanation of how things came about. But what happens when we get to the New Testament? Is it a natural thing for Jesus to come back from the dead? No. So I wouldn't take the need that we have for... I'm not asking when I say that we have a reasonable faith. What I do not mean is that God always works within even his own laws, because God himself can overturn those laws whenever he wants to. And that's where we would differ from those who say, well, we would only believe in that which is natural. I would say, why? Why do we suppose that just because you haven't experienced something supernatural that God hasn't done it in the past? I don't think any of us should make our belief system totally based on our own experience. Because the reality is, you can't experience everything. And this is where faith comes in. But I'm just saying that the atheist has the same kind of problem, that the atheist doesn't have the opportunity to experience everything either. Nobody lives long enough to experience everything. So we all have to make decisions based on other people's experience as well. Study history, study science, etc. My main point about all this is that we have a lot of corroboration of not just creation, but let's say of the flood, from these other places of antiquity. The Bible is by far not the only one talking about a universal flood. And I'm taking it that what we have here is actually a universal flood. There are Christians who believe in a Mideast flood, like Hugh Ross. He says that it seems impossible that the Genesis flood inundated not only all of Mesopotamia, but also the entire Persian Gulf region and southern Arabia as well. So Hugh Ross is saying it was basically a Middle East flood. And he proposes, his presupposition is that there's an old earth. The earth is 14.4 billion years or something. And he says the word world need not mean the entire planet. But others respond to him, like Ken Ham, and he says, well, if the flood was local, why did Noah have to build an ark? I mean, he could just travel over to China. It'd be a lot easier to just pack up your stuff and take a trip to China, don't you think? Than to build an ark for 120 years. You could get to China in maybe 120 days. And the same thing for all the animals. Why have all the animals? Yeah. Why go to all this trouble to bring all the animals on the ark to escape death? It doesn't make sense. Others like Terry Mortensen says, well, if the flood was local, why was the ark big enough to hold all animals? Why not just hold animals for that region? And the flood was local, why would the birds have to be on the ark? You know, birds can fly a long way. Just let them migrate. You don't need to. There's just so many problems, I think, with the local flood view. It specifically says that the waters went 8 cubits or 8 meters above the mountains. Genesis 7 says the waters rose and increased above the highest mountains.
There is evidence also like...
And it didn't look like this, because water doesn't do this.
There is evidence also, Himalayas, they have that seashells.
That's a great point.
They travel when there is pressure, they can't live because the seashells crush. So they have to travel upstream. So if the flood came till the covered all the mountains, so they must have traveled to...
Exactly. How can you explain fossils of sea creatures on the highest mountains of the world?
The Himalayas.
That obviously have been pushed up. There were fossils there, and then these mountains were pushed up. That's exactly what we're saying. We're not saying that the flood happened with the Himalayas, Mount Everest being 28,000 feet. We're saying that there was such an upheaval that all the mountains of the world were covered with water. But then there was also upheaval that pushed up these mountains.
Yeah,
so that's how you have fossils at the top. It's evidence of a worldwide flood. By the way, the professor says, well, look at that beautiful rainbow. It's a promise from God that he'll never again flood the entire earth as he did in Noah's day. And this college student says, well, my Christian college professor said that Noah's flood didn't cover the entire earth. He told you it was just a localized flood? That's what he said. So he believes that God promised to never again send a localized flood? Do you catch the point here? God said he would never send a flood like the flood he sent before. So if that's true, if Noah's flood was a local flood or a regional flood, God has repeatedly broken his promise never to send such a flood again. So that's why I believe that we had the water. It says in Genesis 1, all the water was gathered into one place on the earth, right? If all the water was gathered in one place, that means all the land was gathered in one place too. It was a single bit of land, and that land actually broke up during the great flood. And so we find that in actually the flood significance is talked about in 1 Peter 3 as a signifying God's righteous judgment, his gracious redemption, and even symbolizes water baptism. And we have actually we have 270 so far flood legends from Babylon to Hawaii, Mexico, China. There's differences between them, but the things that they share in common is that the flood was universal, that a boat saved them. Nobody got lifted up by, you know, birds or something like that, or found refuge in an underground cavern. It was always a boat that actually saved them. And then the people who were saved that were on that one boat were actually family passengers. They were all related by blood. These are common elements to all 270 stories. That tells me that we have a common story that got corrupted, but some of the elements have remained in it. And we know that Second Peter says in the last day, scoffers will come. And one of the things that they will say, 2 Peter 3, verse 4, is that everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. These scoffers are going to say, the earth, they're going to just forget that the earth was formed out of water and the world at that time was deluged. We have God saying that scoffers are going to come and doubt the flood, despite the fact that there's 270 stories. So for scoffers today to say everything's remained always like it is, this is called the teaching of uniformitarianism, that the whole world, everything is pretty much uniform, you can just turn the timetable back. That's exactly what God says was going to happen. And they're going to doubt the flood. They're going to doubt these 270 flood stories as well. But we do find these various teachings. We find different types of pagan literature, both historical. You'll read some of this. We have other history writings. We have other books of wisdom. I'm on page 189. We have other stuff that sounds like Book of Proverbs. Incline your ear to wisdom. The Egyptian writing says, give thine ear and hear what I say. It sounds just very, very much like Proverbs, doesn't it? Beware of robbing the poor, oppressing the afflicted. That's not Proverbs. Proverbs says, rob not the poor, for he is poor. That's actually Amen Emopet, the Egyptian writings. We have Egyptian love songs that sound like Song of Songs. Ah, if only I were a laundryman of my sister's garment, for even for one month, he's just loving the smell of her garments, you know. It's better that she's his sister rather than his. And it sounds very much like the clothes being scented like the cedars of Lebanon we find in Song of Songs. And so we find lots of parallels in history, in wisdom, many different wisdom writings that are dealing with a theogony, Babylonian theogony. Why is there evil in the world? Babylonian theodicy, as is similar to the book of Job. Why is there suffering in the world? You know, we even have prophetic literature that comes from Mari, the city we were looking at before. Prophetic literature that they call it prophecy, but they're actually recording history as if these historical books were being predicted, these historical events. But in reality, we're looking back at these histories. We have Amarna letters, Lachish Ostraca, that are letters from different people. We have legal literature that has both similarities and differences. For example, the Hittite treaty that has six parts to it, or sometimes five parts, that looks exactly like we have in the book of Deuteronomy. This is basically your outline of the book of Deuteronomy. It's really quite incredible. The laws of Hammurabi, we find predating Moses by 400 years, and yet there's so many different similarities, except the laws of Hammurabi are not as beneficial. They're not as... It's the king's word rather than the character of Yahweh that is considered the basis. It's very harsh in Hammurabi rather than a reasonable type of punishment that we have under Moses. In any case, all of these things came about from the table of nations. The Japhethites, the Semites, and the Hamites that descended from Noah's three sons. They gave us the various peoples that we have today. In fact, one man, Bill Cooper, studied all those genealogies of all those people. And he says, having constructed the table of nations into a simple genealogy, I wanted to see how many of its names were attested to in the records of other nations in the Middle East. He said, I saw that the table of nations had listed all the families and tribes of mankind in their correct groupings, whether those groupings were ethnological, so ethnic group, linguistic, or geographical. All the names, without exception, were accurate. And in more than 25 years of searching and analyzing, I uncovered not one mistake or false statement of fact in the table of nations. Here's a guy who went through all those genealogies of all those places, and he said they are exactly like Genesis 10 and 11. Surprised? I'm not surprised. The earth is the Lord's. And because the earth is the Lord's and the scripture is the Lord's, he knows exactly how to record it in a way that would be truly, truly honoring his name with accuracy. So trust his word. Trust him.